The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Diane Edelman for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Reader's Digest. Keeper of the Flame. His best friend died a hero's death in Vietnam. 6 decades later, he won't let us forget. By Tom Hallman, Jr. It's late in the evening, and David Nelson finds himself in a familiar spot, at a desk in his home in Houston, typing yet another letter to yet another publication about an old friend, Lee Roy Heron, who died in some godforsaken piece of jungle in Vietnam. It had not gone well the last time the two men spoke. For decades after that, Nelson had not thought much about the man he'd once called his best friend. He'd been angry with Leroy, believing that his death was foolish, as he should never have been in combat. But now, at age 80, and armed with new facts, Nelson has been on a mission to clear his conscience and set the record straight about Leroy Heron's last minutes. For the past 25 years, he has written and sent more than 2,000 letters, emails, story pitches, and follow-ups, enough words to fill several novels, to reporters and editors at various newspapers and magazines, including this one. Obsession is a good word, admits Nelson. He knows his wife thinks he's gone overboard about a man who died 56 years ago. I wouldn't say she's jealous, he said. She just doesn't want me spending a whole lot of time writing letters. She wants me to watch a TV program with her. Nelson struggles to find the words to explain the meaning behind this long odyssey of his. It's easier for him to explain the nuances of a legal brief than to explore the depths of his soul. I don't know, he finally says. I've never been able to piece it all together. Perhaps it's because Nelson fails to recognize that this is not only Heron's story, it's his too. David Nelson and Leroy Heron met in grade school and were known around school as friendly competitors, each pushing the other to do better. In the eighth grade, Nelson won the school spelling bee and went to the national competition. Heron came in second. Both were invited into the National Junior Honor Society. Heron was awarded a citizenship award. Nelson was the runner-up. On the high school football team, Nelson held down left end, Heron left guard. They bonded while walking to and from school. They lived a half mile apart, and Nelson would pick Heron up along the way and drop him off on the return, which gave them time to talk about life. At that age, that meant school, music, movies, and, of course, girls. With each step, they came to understand and trust each other, knowing that they always have the other's back. Both enrolled at Texas Tech University in Lubbock and were admitted to Phi Eta Sigma, a National Freshman Honor Society. In 1964, with the Vietnam War raging, Heron enlisted in the Marine Corps and was sent to a 6-week officer candidate school. He convinced Nelson to enlist, and then Nelson, too, completed an officer candidate program. They each agreed to a 3-year commitment that would start when they graduated. They were excited. Imagine, they'd say to each other, two West Texas friends serving alongside each other as combat infantry officers. But in the spring of 1967, Nelson changed his mind. He wasn't so much afraid for himself, he says, but he feared that he might make a mistake in judgment on the battlefield that would get the men who served under him killed. He transferred into a new Marine program that would extend his deferment if he went to law school. There he would study to become a Marine Corps lawyer, specializing in criminal cases and court-martials. Now came the hard part, breaking the news to Heron. He chose to do so the night of a mutual friend's wedding. After the ceremony, The two sat in Heron's parked car, pondering what the future held in store for them, which included the basic school, where new Marine officers are trained. There, the newly commissioned officers would learn the duties, responsibilities, and skills required of a rifle platoon commander. There was a pause. Then Nelson told Heron he would not be going into combat with him. He was going to law school instead. Even in the dark car, Nelson saw a frown on Heron's face. He waited for an argument, maybe a request to reconsider, perhaps even a good word. Silence. And then, just one word from Heron. Okay. Nelson got out. Never again did they have a meaningful conversation. 2 years after closing the car door on Heron, Nelson returned to his childhood home in West Texas to spend Easter Sunday with his new wife and his parents. He had moved on, and he expected this to be a nice break from the rigors of law school at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. The last he'd heard about Heron, his old friend, had been selected for advanced training at the Defense Language Institute Foreign Language Center in Monterey, California, learning Vietnamese. Nelson took comfort knowing that he and Heron would likely work out of offices far from the battlefield. He'd be surrounded by documents in an office. Heron would be stationed at the Pentagon or at an overseas base analyzing communiques and messages while trying to figure out enemy strategy. After a leisurely Easter lunch, Nelson asked his parents if they'd heard from Leroy Heron. His mother paused. She looked away and then, in a quavering voice, said she'd recently read in the Lubbock Avalanche Journal that Heron had died in Vietnam. Nelson felt sick. His heart raced. He struggled to catch his breath. His stomach screwed up in knots. "What happened?" he asked. She said she knew nothing more. Nelson, a man who doesn't cry, gathered his composure and excused himself. He went to another room and called a high school buddy. He told the man on the other end of the line what his mother had just told him. "It's true," his friend said. "How in the hell did it happen? I thought he was going to be a translator at some base." "He volunteered to go to Vietnam. I don't know why or how, just that he charged the enemy and got himself shot." Nelson hung up the phone. What a damn fool. What was he doing in Vietnam? Why was he on the battlefield? He remembered that in a high school football game, Heron had broken his arm and refused to leave until the coach ordered him off the field and to the hospital. Had that same youthful gung-ho attitude led to his death? A fool. A damn fool. A couple of decades later, in 1990, 16 years after having fulfilled his 3-year commitment practicing military law, Nelson found himself in Washington, D.C. Now a certified public accountant and a partner in an international accounting firm, he was attending a tax seminar. Though the war had not been top of mind for some time, he decided to visit the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. He found what looked like a thick telephone book, all plastic pages, that listed the more than 58,000 names on the wall. He flipped through the pages until he got to the H's and found Leroy Heron's name and his location on the wall. He began the long walk down a slope, which took him to the heart of the dead. He had always thought the memorial was just a wall of names of those who'd paid the ultimate sacrifice for what Nelson had come to believe was a fruitless war. Now, standing before the long list of names, he searched for his friends. There it was, on panel 32W, line 78, etched in black granite. He touched it. An official guide explained how Nelson could take a rubbing of Heron's name by putting a sheet of paper over the recessed lettering and rubbing it with a piece of charcoal. Nelson did so. Then, The man who didn't cry, cried. Nelson, at the top of his profession, was married and had two daughters. What did Leroy have to show for his life? Nothing. What a senseless death. Yes, a fool. Nelson's opinion of Heron took a dramatic turn in the summer of 1997 when he heard retired Marine Colonel Wesley Fox, an old instructor of his, speak before the Texas Association of Former Marines. The topic? The Medal of Honor that Fox had been awarded in Vietnam. Fox set the stage, telling the audience he had been wounded twice in a brutal ambush on February 22, 1969. He was the only officer still capable of organizing the defense. The others had been killed in action or severely wounded. "I want you to understand it's never one person that accomplishes everything," Fox began. "Sometimes you may think that a John Wayne type of person does it all and wins the whole battle. But it's always a combination of people. In my case, two outstanding lieutenants were key to that victory that day. One was a stout young man from West Texas named Lee Heron." Nelson gasped at the mention of his friend. At the end of Fox's talk, he hung back until only he and Fox remained. He reintroduced himself to his former instructor and said he'd gone to school with Heron. "You were a friend of Lee Heron's?" "Well, he was a great guy, you know. He always wanted to be with the men. He'd tell me to get some rest while he scouted the line, made sure the men were dug in properly and not asleep in their foxholes," said Fox. Nelson asked how Heron had died. The two men found seats in the empty room. Then Fox took Nelson back to February 22, 1969. He began with facts and numbers. A Marine company made up of three platoons, 20 or so members in each group, emerged from the jungle to fill their canteens at a watering hole surrounded by trees. For a moment, they could relax. And then, Fox told Nelson, all hell broke loose. Mortars, grenades, and machine gun fire rained down on the company from three bunkers hidden on a hill. It was a well-planned ambush, the enemy waiting patiently, knowing the soldiers had to drink. Fox, in charge of the company, quickly deployed his men. There was no cover, no place to hide, as the trees offered little protection. The plan, made on the fly, was for the platoons to somehow encircle the bunkers and kill the enemy before getting slaughtered. The first platoon leader was shot and severely wounded. But a Marine armed with a bazooka crawled through the jungle, fired, and destroyed one bunker and the men inside. Then the third platoon leader was shot and killed. Fox and his men huddled to come up with a new plan with the leader of the second platoon. A mortar landed in their midst, the shrapnel wounding Fox and others, and severely wounding the second platoon leader. Only one officer among those standing with Fox was left unscathed. Heron. "I had a simple message for Lee. Take over the second platoon," Fox said. "The men in the first and third platoons were pinned down. I told Lee it was up to him. He immediately said okay and led the second platoon up the hill. But they were quickly pinned down. I didn't have much hope that Lee Heron could make a difference." The one thing Heron had going for him was the thick mist that shrouded them. He and his radio man took advantage of the cover, crawling through the jungle to reach the second bunker. It was a fool's mission. Heron had no bazooka or heavy artillery. He carried with him his rifle and the hand grenades strapped across his chest. Heron got about 90 yards away from the bunker, almost the length of a football field. Bullets would be useless against the bunker, Fox had said. Heron's only hope was to throw a grenade through a small opening in the bunker where the enemy fired rounds as if in a shooting gallery. In the best of situations during training, it would be difficult. Here, death almost certain. Heron had to throw the grenade with the skill and accuracy of a pitcher in the seventh game of the World Series. While listening to Fox, Nelson remembered when he and Leroy had competed in a high school competition to see who could throw a softball the farthest. Nelson threw the ball 85 yards. "Top that," he said. Then Heron took the ball and heaved it 90 yards. Among the death and carnage almost 9,000 miles from Lubbock, Heron threw a grenade. Bullseye. Then another. Bullseye. Only one bunker remained. Heron, down to just a few grenades, set out once more with his radio man. Suddenly the sun came out and the mist, their cover, dissipated. The enemy took aim and fired. The radio man, shot in the midsection of his body, survived, but was paralyzed. Heron, shot in the chest, died immediately. Stunned, Nelson listened as Fox told him that he had managed to call in air support to bomb the third bunker since the clouds had lifted. The remaining bunker was destroyed, and the battle ended. 11 men died, and 58 were wounded. Without Lee, it would have been worse. The company could have been wiped out. For his actions, Leroy Heron was awarded the Navy Cross for extraordinary heroism in combat. On the way home that night, Nelson had but one thought. My friend was not a fool. Nelson remained mystified how Heron, who should have been in an office far from the war, had ended up on the battlefield. And so he began his research. He learned that in December of 1968, Heron had checked in at the headquarters and service company of the 9th Marine Regiment, located in Vietnam at the Vandegrift Combat Base, where he was to translate Vietnamese documents. Almost immediately, he pestered his commanding officer to send him to the front lines. Reluctantly, the CO assigned Heron as executive officer of Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 9th Marine Regiment. 2 months later, Heron died, saving the lives of many Marines who went on to live full lives after the war. Nelson reached out to some of those Marines. Here's what one said. When Alpha Company was ambushed, it was Lee who made the sacrifice and took over my platoon when I was wounded. Lee was as brave as he was righteous, moral, and gentle. One thing I can say about Lee Heron, when I was around him, I was the man I wanted to be, not the man I knew I was. Another told Nelson, Lee came up to me after the mortar hit in our midst. I was lying on my back on top of another wounded Marine. Lee knelt down and asked me, having to scream above the roar of the firefight, where my battle dressing was, seeing that I was bleeding. Then he used the only four-letter word I ever heard him say, damn. He was upset by the carnage, but had that look of determination and firm resolve to do his duty. He patted my head and moved off toward the dug-in enemy. Leroy Heron was a rarity, a bona fide hero. But why is David Nelson, a man entering his 9th decade, inundating publications with letters, emails, and story pitches about a man who died so long ago? To some small degree, by trying to get strangers to learn the story of Leroy Heron, he has made amends for that night in the car 58 years earlier. And to him, the obsession, all the thousands of letters that keep him from watching TV with his wife, is a blessing. It keeps Leroy alive in my heart, said Nelson, the man who believes he's more comfortable with facts than with feelings. Then, after a pause, I have dreams. Leroy is alive. Somehow, he didn't die over there. That was Keeper of the Flame by Tom Hallman, Jr. Now here's another shorter article, New Ways to Relieve Pain. Don't resign yourself to a life of discomfort. Here's How to Stop Hurting by Beth Winehouse. Pam H. had always enjoyed hiking, kayaking, and skiing. But beginning in her late 50s, she noticed her left knee was starting to bother her. and soon the osteoarthritis made it too uncomfortable to enjoy the activities she loved. By the time she reached her 70s, it was painful just to walk or drive. She decided to have knee replacement surgery, which had helped many of her friends. Unfortunately, the new knee wound up hurting even more, because it was discovered that Pam was allergic to at least one of the metals it contained. Doctors told her replacing the knee again was not an option, and she would just have to live with the pain. The National Institutes of Health estimates that about 1 in 5 U.S. adults, more than 50 million people, experience chronic pain. Aching backs and knees, neck and shoulder pain, headaches, sore feet, and arthritic hands are a daily part of life for many. Low back pain is one of the most common conditions we treat, says Benjamin A. Howie, M.D., a pain management specialist and assistant professor of anesthesiology practicing at Columbia University Irving Medical Center in New York City. He estimates that once people reach their 60s, nearly half will suffer from some degree of back pain. By the time patients consult a pain specialist, they've usually tried to manage the pain on their own with rest, heat, ice, and over-the-counter medications such as ibuprofen or acetaminophen. And they've probably been to see their primary care provider. But many are still hurting. Pain management is a relatively recent medical specialty. For years, the most powerful and effective drugs in the specialty's arsenal were opioid medications such as morphine, oxycodone, hydrocodone, and fentanyl. But we know these drugs have fueled an epidemic of addiction that killed more than 80,000 Americans in 2022 alone. Most doctors are now reluctant to prescribe them, though these medications still have an important role in easing pain from cancer and surgery, as well as pain that is not helped by other methods. And most patients are reluctant to take them. Does that mean we're destined to keep hurting? Not at all. The options for pain relief are growing at an impressively rapid rate. The field is exploding, says Dr. Howie. People are living longer and don't want to accept chronic pain or immobility, and we can drastically improve their quality of life. Here are a few of the newer drugs and procedures that pain specialists can offer. Injections. Targeted injections with steroid drugs or hyaluronic acid gel can help relieve pain in knees and other joints, while epidural injections into the space around the spinal cord can help minimize sciatic pain in the lower back and down the leg. Alternatives to opioids. New drugs aim to alleviate severe pain without the risk of addiction and without unpleasant opioid side effects like nausea, vomiting, and constipation. One example, the FDA recently approved suzetrigine, a new drug that works by blocking signals in peripheral nerves outside the brain and spinal cord, stopping pain signals from reaching the central nervous system so they are never perceived. Nerve blocks and ablations. Injecting nerves with anesthetics to block pain signals can provide temporary relief. For longer-lasting results, doctors can damage or destroy the portions of the nerves that are responsible for localized pain. The most common of these procedures is radiofrequency ablation, RFA. After determining which nerve areas are responsible for the pain, the doctor inserts a long needle into each, delivering heat to deaden it. This is the option that was recommended to Pam H. Her pain specialist used RFA to destroy the problematic areas of 3 of the 4 main nerves that allow the knee to feel and move properly. A few weeks after the ablation, Pam was relieved that her knee felt numb. When the effect wears off, generally in 6 months to 2 years, nerves can regenerate, the procedure can be repeated. And this is just a sampling. Other techniques for easing pain include spinal cord stimulators to help with chronic leg or back pain related to spinal disease, vertebral spacers that can help with back and related pinched nerve pain, bone cement to help with pain from fractures, peripheral nerve stimulator implants to help with localized pain, intrathecal drug pumps, which are implanted to deliver small doses of drugs around the spine. Some of these options are so specialized that even primary care providers may not know about them. There are still a lot of providers who send patients to us just for opioids, not aware of all these things we can do, says Dr. Howie. He recalls one case that stands out. There was a woman in her 30s who came to see me for horrible neck pain and chronic headaches, he recalls. She had seen at least 15 medical providers over 10 years, and they tried every medication under the sun to help. I did diagnostic neck point injections, a procedure to identify which nerves are responsible for pain by injecting them with local anesthetic. Within 15 minutes of getting the injections, her headaches were gone. I remember she was so happy and relieved that she cried. We've run out of time for today's episode. I'm reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Reader's Digest is available at a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.